Hey everyone, I want to tell you about another Stephen King podcast. This one is hosted by Kim C, who is a university creative writing fiction teacher, and she knows way more about the writing process than I do. And she is covering lesser-known King works in her podcast, The Year of Underrated Stephen King. You can find a link to her show in the show notes, and she is now 50 episodes in, so there's plenty of content there for you to check out, and I hope you enjoy it. Before we dive in today, I want to let you know a few ways you can support the podcast. The biggest one by far is word of mouth. If you enjoy this and you know other Stephen King fans, please tell them about it. Share the episodes on social media. It really does help. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Chat Cemetery. There are links to those in the show notes. And if you are really dedicated to the show, you can become a Patreon supporter where I will have bonus episodes going up. I am covering all of the Stephen King related comics over on Patreon. So there's definitely going to be a lot more bonus content coming this year. And now let's get into the episode. Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and I am joined once again by Katie Schaefer. We're talking all about Under the Dome, which is a very, very long book. I considered making a rhyme there, Katie, and I think you know what I would have been going for.
Yes. Oh, God. This was a really interesting piece of work, I think. I mean, the thing that struck me about it when I opened it is that it's like, okay, this is another town one, like Needful Things or It. And it seems like each one he does of those changes. And I think this one was better, like more tightly written and better paced than some of his other town books.
Which is wild to say for a book that's over 1,000 pages long.
So wild. And he credited, at the end of this, he credited his editor with that. He said that she just wrote him in, like, hard about it. Like, nope, faster, do it faster.
Yeah, and it's funny because even though this book was so long, you didn't really feel it necessarily. There were some stories of King's, Tommyknockers comes to mind immediately, where you really feel the length of the book.
Definitely. And this one, I agree, you don't necessarily. And I mean, the book takes place over a week, I think, because I think the dome comes up a week after it goes down. Their whole town just goes to shit in that week.
Oh, completely. And it's funny to mention some of these town kind of stories that he's done before, too. A lot of them are long. It was also over 1,000 pages, at least my copy was. Needful Things, I think, fell somewhere in the 600 to 800 range or something along those lines. And what I find interesting is that Salem's Lot is the only short town book, really.
Yeah, and that one, I think it has fewer characters in it, but it's still very much a town book because you do get, even with fewer, like, main characters, we'll call them. No pun intended. Yeah. Because they're all set in Maine. Salem's Lot really picks and chooses who we're going to get that perspective of. And it really gives us a few outside ones, and those color the rest of what's going on.
Yeah. And I read a hardcover copy of Under the Dome. Did you read a physical copy or did you do the audiobook?
I did the audiobook.
And let me guess, it was 40 something hours?
It was long, though. Took me like a week and a half to listen to it, listening like every day.
Yeah.
I think it was 36 hours.
I was close.
And it was narrated by Raul Esparza, who did a fantastic job. Very, very well done. Lots of different accents. And some of them didn't feel like Maine accents, but I have spent maybe 2 days in Maine as a child, so I really have no idea what that accent is and what the variations of it are. Mm-hmm. But some of them are just spot on with that, oh yeah, that weird drawl that Mainers have.
Yeah, and I can imagine that this was a lot to listen to because, you know, as someone who works on podcasts all day long pretty much now, it's one of those things where I don't have the attention span necessarily to do that all day and then listen to an audiobook. So for me, it's like reading either a physical or digital book, it doesn't matter, is a break for my ears. So for you, I'm sure, because, you know, you don't work on podcasts all day, it's a bit of a different experience. But with something that long, were you taking notes while listening to it?
I ended up not doing that. And I had planned to initially, but I kind of listened to this one in chunks. I was able to make some time outside of my work day, because usually I listen to these while I'm working. And on the on my more down working days when it's all spreadsheets. So I was able to track pretty well what was going on in the book. And it felt, like you said, this is terribly long, but it doesn't feel that long. And because it happens over that short period of time, it felt easier to recall it for some reason. And I don't know why, because it's totally just a my head thing. But I was by the end of it, I was like, wow, I really feel like I retained a lot of this book.
I'm hoping I retained a lot of this book. But I do want to note that, you know, there are so many characters in this that we probably won't focus a ton on every single one. But the fact that King felt the need to include a character list at the top of this book tells me something about just how involved this story is right off the bat, because the character list is almost 3 pages long by itself.
Oh, yeah. And like when I went into the Wikipedia for this, I was shocked because there's a list of main characters and minor characters. And neither list is conclusive. I was like, you're missing, like, I don't think Joe appears on any of the lists. Oh, no, he's at the very bottom. Okay. But there were a couple of people I just was like, I feel like you're really missing out and not including info about these people, because they did have quite a bit to do with the story.
Yeah. So let me just quickly go over how it was broken down in the book. You have town officials, Sweetbriar Rose staff, police department, pastoral care, medical staff, town kids, townspeople of note, out of towners, and dogs of note. Save the best for last.
He did save the best. I do really enjoy this book. It felt like it more than any other. Like, King's had soft spot for dogs in most of his books. Not all of them, but one or two happy dogs usually makes an appearance. In this one, it felt expanded on, and I loved it. I was like, oh, we're really getting a lot about Horace, the Julia Shumway's dog, and I was there for it every time.
Yeah, and this book weighed 3.5 pounds, so it is a heavy one to read. I would have it sitting on my lap, and I'm like, my legs are getting tired. This is really sad, you know, and just some of those small things he did at the beginning, because there's also a map of the town too, which I find those to be pretty helpful when you have a story of this caliber. So just kind of starting off with those things, I was like, okay, you know, we have something here. It's kind of like when you get the maps in the Dark Tower and you're like, oh, thank you.
Oh, yes. When I read fantasy books, I'm always disapproving if there's no map. I'm like, I would really like to be able to track the passage of these folks, because I know they're going to travel. So I would appreciate that. That's one of the things I miss about reading actual books versus listening to audiobooks, is you don't get any of the supplemental materials.
Yeah. And you can't flip back and forth in an audiobook to be like, who is this character?
Right. It's a lot harder to do it.
So we've been talking for a bit here. We haven't really talked about anything that's happened aside from the dome going down and going up and it spanning about a week. But our main characters are really only a handful, I think, that you spend a ton of time with. You obviously have, you mentioned Julia Shumway, who is the press member of the town, basically. It's just her, pretty much. I mean, there's a couple other guys, like the photographer and things, and then you have Dale Barbie, as he is known, and he is someone who hasn't lived in the town for quite as long as everyone else, from what I understood. It's like he had been there for quite some time, but he had also been there, you know, not enough time to be considered, like, one of the people.
Right. He's still considered an outsider.
But not an out-of-towner.
No, because he'd been there long enough, and because he'd been working at the diner. So he'd been getting to know these people and making them their food, and was considered a good cook. So, and that really helps warm people to you, which is, throughout as the book goes, good for him. Good for him. Because otherwise, I think he probably would not have made it as far as he did.
Oh, absolutely. And Our big bad villain, so to speak, and quite literally big, is Jim Rennie. And everyone calls him, you know, Big Jim. He has a son, Junior. And it really felt like he was a larger-than-life character every time he appeared in a scene in the book.
Yeah. Apparently he was based on Dick Cheney.
Okay.
And I was like, oof, too accurate. Too accurate, Steve. I thought he did such a great job. Like, it was apparent to me. Like, I think I texted you about it. I was like, oh, here's our bad guy. And wow, is he a bad guy. Like, just painfully to the point where I hated him so much. And I was like, I really hope I get to see you go through something awful at the end of this, because you will deserve it. I'm like 3 pages into reading about him and I'm thinking that already.
Yeah, King is so good at writing characters that you just instinctively hate, because I don't know if anyone could read this book and like Jim Rennie.
No, he's very hateable. King does a good job of making him feel not like a caricature, because he definitely throughout it gives us that inside head perspective of Rennie, where it's where Rennie is justifying his behavior to himself. And by the end of it, when he's really gone off the rails, there's been a gradual progression up where you see how ruthless he was when he started, and you see him as he's grabbing more and more and more power, you see him being willing to do worse and worse and worse things to get it and to retain it.
Yeah. And like I said, there are way too many characters here to focus on all of them, but you also have plenty of other people in the town who are just terrible, terrible people because... And trigger warning here, there is a not super detailed rape scene, but King writes it in a way that kind of lets you fill in the blanks in such a terrible way that you know exactly what happened without him having to lay out every single detail.
Right, right. I thought it was very well done. I mean, as much as those things can be well done, you know, it's always going to be painful to read. He does it in a way that I feel is respectful of the victim.
And the fact that it was a bunch of quote-unquote cops who committed this crime.
Right, and that Sammy gets her own back is very comforting. Yeah, and the other big bad I thought we should mention here is Rennie's son, Junior.
Yes.
Because the two of them, like, are kind of the two really nasty antagonists in this book, even more so than Rennie's eventual secondhand man, because Junior is the one who's, you know, he has a brain tumor. So he's just going around brutalizing people and murders two girls he knows in, like, God, the first day, isn't it? Doesn't he kill them kind of like one right after the other?
I think so, because it's Angie and Doty, right?
Right. And Doty is the... feels so bad for that character. And not because of King, but because how he writes about her. She's just obviously like this forgotten person who's mostly neglected by her parents. Yeah. And she's just trying to make it. And we don't even really get to know her. And then she's dead.
Right. And they were both waitresses at Sweetbriar Rose. So they also had this connection to each other. And seem to be friends and get along pretty well. And then you have these terrible things happen to them. And Junior is arguably worse than his father. It's just his father is much smarter than Junior and way more manipulative. But Junior is the one who is more dangerous because he does not have that higher intelligence.
Right. And he's the brain tumor, which is at the point, you know, at the point when the book starts, is already to the almost terminal stage. Mm-hmm. And like, there's no cutting it out at that point. And it's causing him to have these violent rages. And you get the sense that Junior was a bully and an asshole before. But the tumor pushes him to the point of being like a psychotic madman who just loses it and becomes a homicidal maniac, which makes him even more scary because he's so unpredictable.
Another thing that I liked about the characters in this, too, is that the town kids aren't as involved in the story as, say, the Losers Club in It, but they are given enough to do to kind of make you feel that connection with those kids that you kind of feel with the Losers Club. And we don't need to know quite as much about them in order to get that. And obviously, with these books being of very similar length, we get way, way more of the Losers Club. But here, you get just enough of Joe and Nori to know that these are kids who aren't going to give up. There's this thing in their town, well, covering their town, and then there's all these people in their town who are not great, and they are so adamant about being a part of the solution. And it's not every day that, you know, you read about kids who are like that, even in fiction.
Right, exactly. I think if you've read it, for me, I felt like it gave me an extra layer to this book. And I think that's part of just why people read King and why he's so successful, is because the more of his work you read, the more you're able to kind of tease out different aspects of his stories later on. And like, you could kind of picture what Nori and Joe and Benny are going through, even through just the little glimpses we get of it. You know that they're having this, their own crazy adventure, like the Losers Club. We're just not getting to see that because we're focusing on, you know, Barbie and Rusty and all of those folks.
Yeah, I would definitely say that Barbie and Julia are sort of the dynamic duo here, but then you have characters like Brenda and Rusty, who are also heroes in a sense. They just aren't the center of attention necessarily, especially for our bad guys. And to dive into the story, this story doesn't take place over a long period of time. It's a pretty tight-knit story in this tight-knit town where everyone knows everyone, and you kind of get the same feeling you get when you read something like The Mist. Everyone kind of knows everyone's business. That isn't quite as obvious in something like It because of how much it focuses on the kids in particular. You don't really get a ton of the adults in the town. You know, it's more along the lines of, this is what these kids do in Derry, and we're going to see a lot of Derry through these kids' eyes. But in this, you get a mix. You get what the kids are going through, but you also get a lot of all of the tension between these adults, the ones who don't like each other, the ones who are, you know, very buddy-buddy, and you really get a sense of who all of these people are. And even if they aren't major, major characters, King still does a very good job of kind of explaining their role in the town from before the dome dropped.
Yes, and he does it in a real short way. Like, it's not long or exaggerated. We don't get, you know, childhood stories from all of them. We do from a couple, but they very much play into what's going on in the current time. But I still think you get a lot of the relationships. Like, for instance, Rusty ends up being the head medical professional in the town fairly quickly after the dome comes down. And his relationship with Twitch, who is the ambulance driver and nurse, one of the nurses for the town, and the two of them obviously formed this long-term relationship. But it's just in their conversations, in like the scene where where Rusty takes a cigarette, like, it's just these little things that really blossom and give you context for how the people will act later and whose side will these people end up on. Because it's pretty clear from the beginning that there are going to be sides.
And that you have to pick one.
Yes. And that the catastrophes just keep coming one after the other up until the very end of the book. So few good things happen for these people in this week. King shows a whole family just being decimated through various deaths and issues, and then he shows the last family member making it to the very end, and you're just like, oh God, please survive. And you only get a little bit about that family, but it really gives perspective on what all the other families are going through in town who we don't see at all.
He puts everyone in this town under tremendous pressure, and when you put an entire group of people under that much stress, nothing good is ever really going to come of it. Because you look at again, The Mist, you have these people in a confined space. Granted, a grocery store is much more confined than an entire town, but when I look at the map that King provided at the beginning of the book, it's not like this town is massive. Things are kind of spread out because it's in the middle of relatively nowhere, you know. There's not a whole lot going on up in Maine outside of, you know, maybe Portland and a couple other cities.
Well, and this one is real close to Castle Rock, right?
Right.
Because that's where the government makes its head.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like it, and they do mention Derry. But yeah, it doesn't feel that big.
No, and when you look at the map, you're kind of like, okay, the hospital's at one end, Rennie's car lot is at the other end of the road there, and, you know, everything else is, for the most part, falling in between those two places. But it's funny when you read the characters' descriptions of the town, and it just seems so sprawling, even though you have to know, you know, the other side of town is maybe only like, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes away.
Right, a couple miles. Like, you get the impression that the kids can cross the all over the town on bikes.
Yeah.
So it's obviously very small. And since it cuts off, like, right at the town lines, it doesn't include any of, like, the really outsider parts of things. It goes out to the area where there are still farms, and it feels like there's not a whole lot of empty space here. There's a couple of spots, but if there's mostly, you know, there's a camping area, there's the town, there's the neighborhood where most of the families live, and then there's the businesses.
Yeah, and the map is really just giving you the main part of the town, because it's a rectangular map, and we know the dome is round-ish.
Yeah, yeah. I felt was confusing, because you described it as a sock, almost.
Yeah.
And I was like, but if the dome is round, how does that work?
Yeah.
So I just get times I was just like, okay, I'm just gonna think about it and just keep going.
It's just funny how far they made things seem. And then I sit here and I look at the map, and it's like WCIK, the radio station, is right by the church. And they made it seem like it was just so far out there and in the middle of nowhere.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I was really impressed with how well King unspools what's been going on behind the scenes of the past couple years of the town, and it reveals the true depravity and selfishness of Rennie, and that he's slowly just been bilking the town for all this money. And the completely unexpected part of that, he set up a meth lab that turns out to be like one of the biggest meth labs in the country. And it's like, wait, what? You know,
there was, and it's right next to a church.
Right. And the church is the thing that they're funneling the money through. And it's just like, there were a couple of points in this where he pivots, and what comes out, like, what it's revealed that who brought the dome is like, whoa, I was not expecting that. How did it all come together for you? Because that was a really zigzaggy path.
It wasn't King's worst ending, but I have to admit, I was a little confused. I was like, wait, who brought the dome? Am I getting everything all wrong about this book? And, you know, I felt like when you have Julia walking up to the box, and, you know, the box kind of starts floating, and she sees some of Dale's memories and kind of borrows them, I was like, oh, King had to make it weird, didn't he?
Right, right. Give that little bit of psychic. But to be fair, he had been threading that through the whole thing with the people who were having seizures and were able to have precognition about the future. But for those who haven't read it, why are you listening right now? Go read the book and come back, because this won't make any sense, because we'll be here for 4 hours if we try to talk about it like in chronological order, all of it. But it's aliens. It's aliens, folks. It's child aliens who are like poking at an anthill type situation. And when I first found out it was aliens, I was like, I don't know how I feel about this. But then I think it worked for me, because it's like, it's not really the aliens that are necessarily the bad guys. It's Jim Rennie has been using the town so much, and it's all of the factors that were already in place in the town, and then that added level of pressure just makes everything explode. Because it was entirely possible for them to make it through 7 days like that and have no other than the immediate repercussions of the dome coming down when it kills several people, and not have anything like that happen. Because, if they had rationed the gas, if they had, maybe not blown up the meth lab and all of that, all of the rest of the town wouldn't have died horribly.
And they are called Leatherheads,
Yep, that was
to be specific. And I was like, am I picturing these even remotely correctly? And it'll be interesting to see how the show handles some of these kinds of things. And you have all of these painful memories that Julia herself is reliving. And I felt like in that moment, because of how Julia handles it, it works a lot better than the Tommyknockers did for me. And admittedly, I have not really been fond of King's alien stories,
Same,
but I
same.
think it's because when you have something like Tommyknockers and Dreamcatcher, they play a much bigger role. In this, it was way more about the people and the town than it was about the aliens.
Right. They're just kind of
The cause.
the both figurative and literal barrier preventing the people from leaving. And when you trap people, chaos is going to ensue, especially in such a where no one knows why they're trapped. It's all very mysterious. The government doesn't know, and they're taking all of these very extreme measures to try to free people. And you have some townspeople who, oh, we went for groceries. Like there's the pair of children where they're at one of the cabins camping with their mom, and they're like 9 and 3, I think. And she went to go get some groceries before when the dome came down. So they're just left by themselves. It's just those little instances like that that make it feel like the alien part of it is just kind of a setup. And what's really interesting and what's going on is watching the town react to this crisis.
Right. And the whole cause and effect, the cause is not the focus, which I think is very important. Because if it had just been a group of people focused on the dome and nothing else, this story would have fallen apart about 100 pages in.
Right. There wouldn't be enough to go on because, I mean, they don't find out what's really going on with the dome until maybe the last 200 pages would be my guess, because it's like the last 6 hours of the audiobook is when they finally figure out like where the box is and what's going on.
Right. And we have to talk about some of the major events that lead up to this, one of them being Barbie being framed for murder, because Jim Rennie knows that something isn't quite right with his son, and he just wants Barbie out of the way because Barbie poses a problem since the president is aware of his existence, and you have the military calling him back to service, basically, to figure this all out. So Jim does not want to lose his power. And it's funny because he is second selectman. He's not even first selectman. And then the police chief, well, first off, the first police chief dies because his pacemaker explodes when he gets too close to the dome. So then Peter takes over, and Jim just walks all over this guy. And it's like this town's police force completely goes to hell.
And it's like predicted from because we get things from the original chief Howie, I believe, because that's the only name I can remember because that's what his
Duke.
wife calls him. Duke, thank you. So Duke, the original chief of police, we get a tiny bit of his perspective before he dies. And you get the sense of like, oh, thank God, at least this guy is competent and willing to stand up to this Rennie guy and phew, at least there's someone in control in the town who isn't a complete idiot. And then he dies. And it's just like, God damn it. And it's like, okay, things are going to get real, real bad, which you can always assume with a King book. But with this one, it's foreshadowed so heavy that there were certain times where I just had to put the book down because I was like, I don't want to know. this is just going to be too bad. And felt like it was full of this feeling of dread. Like, I don't know if I want to see how bad this one gets.
And they just kept laying murder after murder on him when it's like, okay, there's no way he could have done all of these, you know, just by the fact that he was with other people. And, you know, that story unfolds, but he was accused of killing Reverend Lester Coggins, who was laundering money for Big Jim, Duke's widow, Brenda, because Brenda finds this file. And I believe it's called Vader, which I enjoyed the Star Wars reference there. And
Me too.
she starts telling Barbie all about this. And the goal is sort of to get that file to Julia, and Julia will keep it safe. And then Jim also kills Brenda. So you have the Rennie family being the most problematic out of everyone in this story by far. And, you know, they also accuse him of killing Angie and Dodie and, you know, doing all sorts of other things to them, which we know for a fact was Junior because those things are laid out for us ahead of time.
Right. And then they go so far as to try to make him the boogeyman, where it's not just that he did all these murders. You know, Rennie doesn't like Julia, she's not just the journalist, she runs the local paper. He doesn't like her because she's been investigating him for years. So he has her paper burned down. And then they plant the idea in the town's head that these are the friends of Barbara. Friends of Barbie, so that it's not just Dale Barbie who's terrible. He also has all these phantom bad guys who will wreak havoc if they don't get what they want. And it's just like, it's so affecting and effective at setting up how us, the readers who know everything that's going on, or most of it anyway, we understand that Barbie is innocent. But with how well Rennie like lays the lines down and the plot, we can also sympathize with the folks who don't know that Barbie is innocent and who are willing to just, okay, sure, whatever. This is the bad guy. Certainly not this man I've known my whole life. It's this random out of town guy.
The way everything comes together in this just works so well because you have some instances where terrible things happen to characters, but they are able to sort of have their triumphant moment. You mentioned Sammy getting that earlier when she is in the hospital. It is very clear what has happened to her, to the staff at the hospital, who's left at the hospital, I should say. And then you have her shooting Frank De Lesseps, who was one of the men who raped her. And it's one of those things where you don't want to necessarily condone a lot of the things that happen here, but you understand why they had to happen. And I'm not talking about the rape, obviously. I'm talking about her shooting Frank and then committing suicide.
Right. And that feels like the only thing she can do.
She also shot Georgia, excuse me.
Yep. After the rape happens, they tell her, if you tell anybody, we're coming back and we're going to do worse. And then it gets the one of the other characters, Piper, who's one of the priests in town, finds out, confronts them. So it gets out. And so she knows that, like, they're in the dome. She has nowhere she can run. She doesn't have a lot of friends in town who will protect her, who can protect her even. So she feels that, like, this is the only thing I can do. This is how I can get back at them. And she leaves her infant child behind, who, even though she's definitely not the best mom, you can see that she really loves her baby and really cares about him. And I found it very interesting that they named him Little Walter, with little being the first name. I was like, oh my, that's a druggy name for your child if I ever heard one.
But it's true to the character.
Definitely, absolutely, it works. The complications that King sets up with, like, that Sammy is the meth cook's wife. And the weird, ironic thing is that she did have someone who could have very much protected her and could have brought the wrath of hell down on these folks had she known where he was, because the chef is He's the one who makes the meth. He knows all the secrets. And if he had known something like that was happening to his wife, he certainly wouldn't have allowed it to happen and would have taken swift and terrible vengeance because he certainly talks about it when he finds out what happened.
And on a quick character note, just because it popped in my head, he names a character Jack Reacher in, honor of Lee Child and the famous Jack Reacher character.
Yep, and connects that. I saw that little bit and was like, huh, somebody likes somebody else's books.
Yeah, and obviously, we mentioned the Vader reference. You had a reference to it that you brought up with the silver eyes, correct?
Yep. During the rape, one of the boys who's doing it, Sammy looks at him and his eyes are glowing like silver coins, and that's totally an it reference. And they do mention Derry and some of the they do make allusions at some point to the weird things happening in Derry, I think, but it's just like this very passing thing from someone who has relatives in Derry.
Yeah, plus you have the fact too that we're not even seeing everyone in the town. This is just who was there on Dome Day, because you have some instances where someone's dad was out of town for a business trip or something, someone's mom left town to go to a different grocery store because she preferred that one in Castle Rock instead of the one in town, and you have all of these people from the town who are trapped outside of it too. And you don't even really consider that while you're reading this because of how much is going on within the dome. But when you really sit with this book and you're like, oh man, this is a lot to process. And you mentioned the family that had the one survivor at the end there, and you're kind of like rooting for him and rooting for him. And he's kind of making this connection with one of the military men. And it's just small things like that that really rounds out this story.
Yeah, it feels like so it, a lot of the times I know from reading books that King has written about how he writes and his many, many author's notes that I love that he gives, he gets ideas in his head of scenarios. What would happen if aliens came to town and poisoned the entire town against each other? Tommyknockers, or what would happen if a vampire came to a small main town, Salem's Lot? And this one is very obviously what would happen to a small town if it was confined. And that really comes through in the story that this is a scenario because you can kind of, as I was reading it, I was thinking to myself, like, what would I do if a dome came down around Minneapolis, where I live. I mean, Minneapolis has roughly 300,000 people living in it, so it would be a very different situation. But I could still like extrapolate how, if I were in that situation, how would I react? Who would I trust?
Even though this is a small town, there are still quite a lot of people because you have, it says, 26 survivors at the end. And given that we know a ton of people died, it's not like this town was only 100 people. It was definitely, I think, somewhere closer to,
1,000, because it
yeah.
mentions that 800 and some people die on Visitor's Day when the meth lab blows up and the fire spreads through the town. So I would guess roughly 1,000 people probably live in this town, which is not huge for, like I said, Minneapolis is 300,000 people, and you live by, Denver, which is probably about the same. But 1,000 is not that big, but it's still a lot of close connections that people have.
Because the area that we spend time in, a lot of it is sort of the main drag, if you will. It's where the grocery store is, the hospital, the diner, the health center, I think, is right next to the hospital, the church. And so it's kind of like you're on Main Street, essentially. I don't think it is called Main Street, but it's one of those things where you're in a specific area and you get the feeling that Chester's Mill is bigger than what we're seeing, but a lot of it is rural. So you have farms and you have, people who live on quite a bit of land, from what I can tell. So even though it's a quote unquote small town, the main part of town does feel that way, but it's kind of sprawling once you leave that main section, but we don't really leave it all that much.
Yeah. It feels like there's lots of dairy farms, and there's a couple of pumpkin farms and stuff like that around. But, and like I said, there's a couple of areas that are just not populated that we go to later with the hero group, I like to think of it as. Yeah, it feels very close. Like once you get near the end, when Rusty and Barbie have been arrested and the group of heroes is trying to flee the town, it's like a nail biter because, you know, they run into one of the groups runs into Jim Rennie's truck and they're just like hiding a van behind a tree. It's like, okay, that's weird. I feel like that would make me notice a van more if it was hiding behind a tree than if it had just like parked on the side of the road. But you know, it feels like there's so few avenues out. It's not like, and like even at the beginning, King lists how many roads there are out of town, and it's actual roads, I think, are like three. And then he names a bunch of cow paths and like old roads that aren't used anymore, that type of thing. So it feels like a very small area.
And you have Little Bitch Road.
Little Bitch Road. Gotta love Little Bitch Road. I think he really enjoyed naming that one.
He really did. And you don't necessarily know quite how big of an area the dome is covering, but you eventually kind of feel like it's one of those towns where everyone kind of congregates in a handful of places, and that is how everyone knows everyone. Because when you think about it, you know, even if this is, say, 1,500 to 2,000 people in the town, how likely are you just in Minneapolis, let's say, to know that many people?
Right. No. No. I mean, I don't because I don't.
Because you have, you know, 20 different grocery stores that everyone goes to. And, you know,
exactly.
It's not like there's one church, one grocery store, one radio station. You have so many more things in a bigger city. And, you know, you could even argue it's the same with Portland, Maine. And it really felt like even though it was a large number of people, there weren't a ton of unknowns about this town and the people in it.
Right. I mean, I thought the thing that described to me how small this town was is that there's one bar and one restaurant, and it's a diner, so it doesn't serve booze. So in the area that one bar can service all those people, and maybe this is because I live in Minnesota and I'm close to Wisconsin, which has like the most per capita bar. There's more bars than churches in every town in Wisconsin. So I was like, there's one bar? How the hell do they all make do with that? And it's so that to me more than anything else. And I think there's one grocery store and then like Stop and Save or whatever, you know, like a big bodega is what I would think of it as. And everybody goes through there. And even the people who we don't see for more than like two pages where they just make a little appearance, like Henrietta or the old lady who, how does she put it? She breaks her ass. She's like 80 years old or something. And then we see her a little bit later. Like you get the sense that these are people who are known in town. Like everybody knows who that 80 year old lady is. And everybody knows who Julia Shumway, the newspaper lady, is. So it feels like you said, like there's not a lot of unknowns and there's not a lot of unknown people in town, even if we don't see them. Like everybody kind of knows who everybody is.
And as someone who now lives in a smaller town, so to speak, in comparison to, you know, when I lived in California, you know, there's one or two, they're not even really bars, they're breweries. So I guess they are. One serves food and one does not, but they're not like your typical bar setting necessarily. And even though I've been to one of the two for meals and whatnot, and you know, we have two grocery stores down, I want to say 3 miles down the road maybe, and it's like I don't know anyone aside from our like immediate neighbors. So you have to understand that in this kind of town it's just different, because even though I'm in what some people would consider a smaller town, we're right outside of Colorado Springs.
Right. And I get the sense that before the dome comes down, that's kind of how those folks are, that like, oh, well, I just drive over to Castle Rock, or I
Yeah.
just drive to, you know, Derry or Portland or Bangor or whatever. And they don't necessarily feel like a small town, like they are, but they're very connected to the space around them, and they only realize just really how small they are once the dome comes down and they're restricted to like this fairly arbitrary space. Because as towns spring up, like the lines that divide one town from another, because I think the next closest town to them is Mauton, so it's the Mauton town line where the dome comes down. They don't even realize really how small their town is, and so it immediately becomes their trapped. It really enhances that feeling of being trapped, because I think it talks about the dome comes down sometimes in the middle of somebody's field, where half the field is in one. And like, oh God, that poor lady who loses her arm in the very beginning when she's gardening in the back. She's gardening in her back, and the dome comes down, and it comes down right on her arm, and then she dies from blood loss. And it's like, whoa. Whoa, and that really to me showed the limitations of thinking of things as like, oh well, you know, there's not really that much difference, say, between Chester's Mill and Mauton, but when you really get down to it, it's a very small area.
And the big difference is between a place like that and where I am now is that these are all family-owned places. You know who owns the grocery store. You know who owns Sweetbriar Rose because it's Rose. It's literally in the name. And here, you know, it's
Burpee's
like
department store.
our two big stores are Safeway and Walmart. And it's like those are not family-owned.
Well, Walmart still technically is,
Technically, they
but
are.
we won't get it. We won't
Technically.
get into that.
But not local family, I mean.
Right. It's not one family running the whole thing in every store.
Right. So it's just a different vibe that you get from this kind of town. And I think the story is one that works because of how character driven it is.
Definitely. I think the characters, and especially the generous blend of characters that we get. Like, I know that King, one of the many criticisms of Stephen King is that he has a lot of times too many characters, too many voices in his stories. But I think it really works here. And it had, like, I don't think it worked in Tommyknockers, but almost nothing works in Tommyknockers. But that's the best example of like too much. Just entirely too much in all ways. When with this, we don't keep going back to like the lady who broke her ass. Like, we only see her twice, and it's mostly for comedic effect. And there's not a lot of comedy in this book, so it's very welcome. He really uses the smaller characters judiciously to illustrate something that's going on, or to describe like the consequences of something happening. And that works tremendously well. And then it allows the more main characters like Barbie or Julia or Rusty to really drive the story forward. And we get so much. I think I really enjoyed, although I hated Jim Rennie, I really enjoyed how much detail we got about his thought process, his history, like why he does what he does. Like, we find out that he killed his wife. You know, that was the first person he murdered. And it's just kind of dropped in there. But we get so much perspective on how this terrible, terrible person has such tight control over these people and is able to manipulate them so well.
What makes it work, I think, too, is the fact that the story isn't told from one character's perspective.
We get a lot of different varieties, so we can see a lot of the different things that are happening. And I think this one, more than any of the other town books I've read, is a culmination of his ability to do that, because the story feels very overarching and gives us a good perspective of all the different sides of what's happening, especially once we start getting it from like the chef's perspective, and he sucks in the first selectman, Andy, and we see them deteriorate very quickly together.
Very
You know,
quickly.
we really get to see a lot of the overarching picture of what's happening here. And then he does a very good job of making the people who don't know the overarching history, or the whole story of what's going on, contribute to that story without needing to know any of those things. Because they're just, as Julia says, they're just living their little lives.
Yeah, and I've been sitting here as we've been talking, trying to think of how I would describe the plot of this book, because really it's like this dome comes down, and people's animal instincts just take over to the extreme. And there isn't a ton of big plot moments in this. It's like, here's this one event that happens and it causes all of this chaos. But if you just pick out one little piece, like Barbie being framed for murder, for instance, that itself is not a big enough plot point to explain everything that's going on. You know what I mean?
I think I liked that part of it because it allows it all to kind of feel like a puzzle that you're putting together. And then I would say the middle third of the book, which comes, I would say is kind of designated by the food riot, the very orchestrated food riot that Rennie causes to happen. And that is where things kind of pivot into being like, oh, it's going to go so much worse than I thought it was going to be. And I already expected it to be terrible. Like, I really didn't expect this ending. Not even when we're talking about the aliens, like how few people survive, 26 people out of all of this. And we see a lot of hard death. And I think, but most of it doesn't happen until the end. And it's such a good way that we're kind of attached to a lot of different people in the town, and we kind of watch them all have this experience together and see how it affects them, and then see the tragedies that come out of Rennie's choices. Because like I said, they're under the dome for a week. It didn't need to, they had more than enough propane, more than enough food. Like, and if Barbie had been put in charge and was able to ration all this and like help people out, it would have been fine. But because Rennie is making that power grab and just trying to force the whole town to accept him as dictator, essentially, mm-hmm. we see that that is what brings everybody down. Because instead of acting like, not to quote Men in Black or anything, but, you know, a person is one thing and people are another. And King really highlights that in a couple of scenes, and one of them is the food riot.
Yeah.
And another is the town meeting where Andrea Grinnell, who's the third selectman, dies after, which, God, was she just a poor woman. Mm-hmm. She does all that effort to get sober off of Oxy by herself, which is just, okay, you're kicking essentially a heroin habit by yourself. That's crazy. In effort to save the town.
Well, Horace was there.
Horace was there for some of it. Yeah, yeah. And I had to admire her. Like, I was really rooting for her. And then Same. She goes to she goes to the meeting with the gun in her bag and is like, oh, crap. Well, I could see something bad's going to happen here. Like, he just sets up all of that so well. And that makes it feel, once you've read the book, once you've got about halfway in, you can kind of tell what's coming next.
So here's how I think this book differs from some of the other King novels. When the dome comes down, he's not giving you all of the information as to what this is and why it's here and why it picked this particular town to come down on. But when you read something like It, you know what the goal is pretty early on into that book, I would say. You know that Pennywise comes back every 27 years. You know that the Losers Club has to defeat Pennywise for this to be over. So therefore, you know this is all building up to this big battle at the end with Pennywise. But with the dome, you never really know what it is or why it's there until, like you said, that last 100 to 200 pages, really. And even when you're, you know, 50 pages from the end, you're not 100% confident they're going to be able to get rid of the dome.
Yeah, I mean, I think he brings this ending. Like, King has kind of two styles of ending that I've seen. One where, I was like, Gerald's Game is probably the best example, mm-hmm. where the story that we've been looking at ends, and then we see the aftermath. Rose Matter is another one.
Yeah.
Both of which we've talked about. And in this one, he chooses to do the opposite, where he brings the story right up until the end. And then immediately after the denouement of the story, he ends it. And we don't necessarily get like an afterword or anything like you do in some of his other work.
Which sometimes is unnecessary. So I like that he just kept it here.
Totally. Like, I didn't need to know if Julia and Barbie live happily ever after. I didn't need that. I was satisfied with this ending and felt like it was a very good one, and it was a really great summation, despite the alien stuff does kind of feel like it comes out of nowhere, but it feels much more like it's a tool in order to tell this other story. And then it's the final step that they have to defeat in order to not suffocate to death because there's no good air anymore. And it makes it interesting. It gives an interesting challenge for these characters to overcome after they've already overcome the challenge of Jim Rennie, destroying everybody for his own personal gain.
Right. There's one aspect of the story that we haven't touched on just yet, and we haven't really mentioned Cox in general, because he's, the military man in charge. He's the one calling Julia and Barbie and kind of being able to communicate with whoever he wants in the dome. And he really acts as this antagonizing force for Jim Rennie. And that's where some of the humor comes into this. You mentioned there's not a ton of it in this book, but when you do get it, you just root for it because you have this moment where Big Jim and Colonel Cox are on the phone and he's just going at him and going at him. And even though Colonel Cox has absolutely no idea what's going on either, and they've shot missiles at the dome, they've gone to the extreme to try and figure this out. And it's something where the military failed, but
Right.
Colonel Cox accomplished everything he needed to, in a sense, aside from figuring out the whole dome thing. But in a way, he played the perfect role that was needed of him.
Right. He's their connection to the outside. And I just love that character, I gotta say. I would love to see another book with him show up in it because he's just perfect amalgamation of like military hard ass and snarky guy and all of that. It's a great trope that King fulfills well. And I loved seeing him because we don't get a lot. Do we get any scenes from his perspective? I didn't think we did.
I don't think so.
So we just see how he is reacted to within the town because he call, like you said, he can call and contact anyone. And he starts with Julia and Barbie and eventually has to work with Jim. And then when things all go to shit, he calls Jackie, which is where the Jack Reacher reference comes. And we kind of get to see a few different sides of this guy. And I loved the antagonism between him and Julia. I thought that was just so perfectly done because he's not, you don't come across as he's like a heroic, nice guy or anything. You get the sense this is a man who's just trying to do a job and he's very military and government minded, but he's integral to them communicating with the outside world. And a couple of times is very integral to guiding how Jim does things so that the hero group can succeed in their goals.
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted to make sure we mentioned him for sure because he kind of just popped in here and there, but it was enough to sort of amplify any situation that he kind of popped into. And, Katie, we said at the top of this that this book is just so long. We could talk about it for hours and hours. And, I was like, I know we don't make Google Docs, and I was thinking about making a Google Doc because, you and I have talked enough to have this down, and I kind of regret not making a Google Doc, but at the same time, like I said, it's just a lot of smaller things building up, and it's not like there's this big plot-driven story. It's all of these little character moments along the way that really build up this town and the people in it, and the dome is just amplifying how these people already felt about each other.
That's the best way to put it. It amplifies all of their relationships because there's no getting away from each other. And then when a tragedy happens, there's no escaping it. I think that was really well illustrated with the family that's slowly disintegrating. The Dinsmores is their name, and Ollie Dinsmore is the survivor. And we see, their second son dies first, and then the mom kills herself from suicide because she can't live with it anymore. And then the dad is drinking himself to death and then eventually kills himself. And then Ollie is left because I think he wakes up on the morning of Visitor's Day, which is the last day of the book, or the it's the day the meth lab explodes. He wakes up and he finds his dad and has to deal with that. And then all of a sudden, the 50th catastrophe is happening, and he has to find a way to survive, and does so with oxygen tanks and all this. I think that story really encapsulated the non-main character costs, like the civilian costs of what was going on here for the people that we didn't really see, because these folks didn't have any direct effect on the story or anything like that. They're
Right.
just trying to live their lives, and it gives a very human perspective on everything.
And like you said, there's no aftermath in the story. So King leaves it open-ended to where you understand that these 26 survivors are going to have to live with this for the rest of their lives, but it also gives you some hope that they have a much deeper appreciation of everything they have now, too. And you said specifically, we don't see, if Barbie and Julia live happily ever after. And we don't necessarily need the two of them to live happily ever after together. We just need to know that, these 26 people, they'll probably be okay.
Right. And you know that, like, they're probably going to suffer some pretty severe health effects from being in a dome that has got meth lab air. Because when the meth lab explodes, there's like, what did I say? Like between 300 and 400 propane tanks. So it's this giant fire explosion that sucks in all the oxygen. And so the only thing that's left is the toxic chemicals from the meth lab and carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. So the vast majority of the town is no longer habitable while the dome is in place. And that is why the vast, if you don't get killed by fire, you're dying from no air. And so you know that these people are going to suffer ill health effects from it for the rest of their lives. They're going to have the horrific trauma for the rest of their lives. And I think King made a good choice to just like cut it off at the end and allow us, we just get to see them make it through this. And then they get to go off and live their lives afterwards as characters in our heads, as opposed to we get the details about what they go through.
Yeah, well, I think the time has come for us to start wrapping this one up. And I kind of had a tough time with rating this because I wasn't super thrilled about the alien presence. And I did still feel like it was a little too long. Like there were probably certain events that could have been cut altogether, and we probably could have had the same outcome and understood things as we understood them with as much story as we got. So I lean towards a 3.5 out of 5 on this. How about you?
I would say I'm at a 4. And this is why, because like I said, I had some hard times reading it where there were times where I was like, I can't face this today. I can't face this today. I'm going to watch some Red Letter Media on YouTube or something while I work. But when I was done with it, I found myself like, oh yeah, I got to turn my, oh wait, no, I finished that book. Oh, but I would like to know more. So I was like, okay, this might actually be something that I'll read again and look for the deeper nuances. And I might actually read it this time because sometimes I can pull things away from it reading it as opposed to audiobook listening.
Yeah.
But I was really impressed with how well told this story was. And I have to emphasize again, I talked about this at the top of the show. The author's note in this one was very interesting because of how he talks about that his editor was really hard on him, requiring, like, demanding that he keep up the pace and not get bogged down in the details. And I think that King's stories really benefit from that when someone is goading him into staying on topic and staying on task, because he has this tendency, as we all know, for those who have long listeners, he really loves to expound on things and give us all the background and detail. And sometimes it's just not necessary. And while I agree, there was stuff that like we really didn't need to know in this and that could have been cut, there wasn't as much of it as in some of his other books. And I think so much of the book really contributed to the tension of the story and the ever-increasing pressure, because like the folks in the dome, the reader is feeling that pressure because you can see that this is a precarious situation. And then by the end, when, in order to make it, what do they say, half a mile away, they're like taking tires and breathing the air out of the tires because they have no other option. So there's just this constant rising internal pressure within the story. And I think King does that so well. And I, because he had an editor who was able to help him keep the story where it needed to be.
I wouldn't say I would read this one again just because it's a lot. And I felt like I remembered enough of the story to know why I liked it and why it was a little different from some of King's other town novels, like you mentioned. But at the same time, for me, the ending was fine. It wasn't by any means his worst ending, and it wasn't the worst use of aliens either, but I don't know what it was about this. I do think it's kind of an underrated Stephen King book. And look, a 3.5 out of 5 is not bad. For the most part, I have leaned 3 stars and above on most of what I've read, with a couple of exceptions, like we mentioned, you know, Tommyknockers and Dreamcatcher, not my favorites. And who knows if there will be another one in the future that is not my favorite. I think I have about 15 or 16 books left by this point, and I don't regret reading it. So I think that's why it's okay with me that the ending wasn't completely perfect.
Yeah, and I agree. Like I said, I think I really love when King does this, when he branches out, or well, not branches out, but when he tackles doing something really complicated. Because we've talked before about like when he did the Green Mile, you know, he's doing something new and different and trying to keep things fresh. And I love that even at, God, what is he, like 75, he's been writing since, been publishing since he was like late 20s, I think, is when Carrie came out.
74, I believe, is the date on Carrie. So he's coming
Yeah,
up
he
on
had to be.
50 years now.
Yeah.
That's
So yeah,
terrifying.
so mid-20s. I know, right? I'm sure it's even more terrifying to him. But he just keeps pushing himself. And he's not like a no, to be clear. I have no judgment and no problem, and I am not denigrating these authors when I say this, but he is not like a James Patterson or a Tom Clancy or a John Grisham, where we're just kind of getting the same kind of story retold in a different, in a little bit of a different way. With King, he really tries to push his boundaries and make something new and different and tell us something we haven't seen before. And I thought this was a really amazing effort on his part to do that. And he, probably more than anyone, knows the criticism he faces when he puts out these 1,000-page tomes, but he just keeps doing it because, number one, because he can. And number two, because he feels he has a story that people want to hear. And I'm one of those people who do want to hear them, even if I don't end up thinking they're, you know, the best thing ever, which this isn't the best thing ever, but it's pretty, if that's what you're looking for, you want to hear a King Town story, you want to read something desperate and intense, this is going to give you that.
And the thing about the authors you just mentioned, because there are books from all of those authors in this house as well, is that their stories are based on characters usually. So there's a series that centers around an entire character. So it's more like each book is an episode of a procedural TV show.
Yes. Yep. That's a really great way to put it. And I have plenty of those authors that I read too. I'm
Right.
personally, I really like the Bones books, and those are very much that, where it's an episode in this character's life about crazy random events. And King has those too with his Mr. Mercedes books, but I just really love that King continues even in, I mean, he would have been in his 60s when he wrote this one because it was 2008, right? He's still trying to push himself. And from what I've read in his most recent stuff, I think I read The Outsider was the last King book I've read that's come out. He's still pushing himself. And I think that's admirable for someone who's been, how do they put it, the writer closest to the fireplace for the longest time. Right now, he's like the Dickens of his era, except longer lived.
Yeah. Well, Katie, thank you so much for listening to many, many hours of this book to discuss it with me. We will be discussing the show as well, which is three seasons. So you and I probably need to get to work on that soon.
Yeah. 33 episodes, I think it is.
Not too bad.
Or no, 39, because it's 13 episodes a season.
Ah, yes, yes. But that's still not too bad. I mean, I watched six seasons of Lost, and that was wild.
Yeah. And how many of The Dead Zone?
All of them.
Yes. So I'm 80? Excited. And I will say, oh God. So I will say, I think this one, since we're covering the show, I wanted to say, I haven't seen anything of the show. Haven't read anything about it. I am really interested to see how it comes out because I think it could be really good. I believe it's a CBS production because they do most of King's stuff.
I think it was Spielberg's company doing it as well. I only looked up the cast and very minor details about it, but the cast is kind of crazy. I mean, it's definitely like a network TV cast, but there's some returnees to the King universe with this one.
Excellent. Excellent. I'm really excited to see if they can pull this off. Like, I think it could make a good TV show, unlike some of King's stuff where I'm like, no, why would you adapt this? This is like trying to adapt Watchmen or another Alan Moore property to film. It doesn't work. But I think this one has a lot of good opportunity in it. So I'm really hoping that they pull it off and it's not like, you know, the 90s, The Stand or something like that.
We'll see.
Or God, what was that one? The Golden Years?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I don't think it'll be that bad.
No, I hope not with 39 episodes to watch.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I watched 80 episodes of The Dead Zone, so.
We can do it regardless.
Yeah, we'll be fine. We'll survive.
Yes.
All right, Katie. Well, thank you again. You will be back soon.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope everyone listened and enjoyed it.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.